Welcome to this week's Two Men in the Middle. This is two guys from the Midwest get together to talk about politics and current affairs. I'm Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Kinnig.
And this week, the week that just kept going and going, the week before Christmas, the week that it looks like the Trump agenda fell apart. If you believe the mainstream media, the wheels came off the Trump wagon. Or is this just kind of par for the course for the Trump presidency, and he'll regroup, regain, and get back up and back to where he needs to be?
Well, I mean, we've had up until this point like this steady drip of, chaos. And I would describe this week as just utter chaos. Yeah. I mean, everything coming loose. It was like the floodgates being opened in terms of the events this week. And it shows that nobody's in control of the White House. And The president himself isn't even in control of his agenda, whatever that is. And it's changing, day to day, as we saw with what transpired with the budget shutdown.
Yeah. So let's start a little bit with just to level set everybody. So we're sitting here on Friday afternoon. As we sit today, the two big things kind of dominating the headlines is, one, Defense Secretary Mattis resigns. That happened yesterday. And it's not only that he resigned, it's in the way that he resigned, and it's in the letter.
The resignation letter. And I encourage everybody to read his letter if they haven't, because he does not shy away from describing the differences in opinion that he has with the president. He touches upon the alliances and partnerships and why the international order is critical for stability and for American influence in the world, the importance of NATO. And he even says we must, quote, be unambiguous in how we treat our allies, treating them with respect, being conscious of, Russia and China. Yeah. And the fact that they're authoritarian states and their interests are not allied with us. I mean, it's a complete repudiation of the Trump foreign policy.
And this usually isn't how a general does it.
No.
They're very much
not
chain
this publicly.
Of command.
Not
this one. They don't write letters like that. And I heard that when he went in to resign, he printed off or gave like 50 copies of that letter to staff with specific instructions to distribute it once he got out of this meeting. So this was kind of a planned resignation.
It was, and
he
went in with that in mind. I think that this was going to happen at some point, and so it was building. And the catalyst, for the actual resignation this week was the decision by the president to withdraw troops from Syria, completely against the advice of his cabinet and General Mattis, and the way he announced that, announcing it publicly via Twitter, blindsiding his cabinet and his officials. And I think that that was the final straw probably for General Mattis to say, no, this, I'm done.
And basically what Mattis was saying was, I believe in the last 70 years post-World War II military and United States foreign policy. The foreign policy.
The post-World War II.
Absolutely.
World order that was established that, and the system of alliances that was built after that, the NATO alliance, and the fact that that has been completely usurped, by Trump's foreign policy, which is all seems to be based on advantage and being able to play off.
Well, I think when Trump's in trouble, he goes back to his two core pillars, isolationism and white grievance.
Right.
And I think you saw him just make this pivot into isolationist policy.
Completely. Yeah. Withdrawing troops is part of that. But I would say his overall policy, in addition to being isolationist, is transactional. It's a transactional based foreign policy. What do you do for us? And then we will reciprocate. If I, as president, don't feel like you're doing enough for us, then you're not going to be an ally, or we're not going to treat you with the respect we've typically treated you, despite, decades and decades of shared history, of democratic values, of, fighting alongside each other in wars, world wars. All of that goes out the window, because with Trump, it's all transaction-based.
Well, and I think, too, I'd love to sit here and just say, as the liberal, I could get my hippie on, and we need to bring everybody home. We don't need to build an empire. You can channel your internal Rand Paul, who just wants to have no U.S. troops on any foreign soil. But the reality is the world is a better place when the U.S. military is engaged around the world.
And the places where our troops are engaged, that acts as a buffer. And not only protects us in the case of being able to fight ISIS and terrorists abroad rather than on our shores, but it also has an impact on our allies, on being able to provide a buffer for them in the region. For example, this decision to withdraw and make this announcement the way it was made from Syria has an impact on Israel, which is clearly reacting. It has an impact, too, in terms of Iran, giving them more leverage in the region, as well as Russia, too. So there's going to be a ripple impact, you know, geopolitically, in terms of the states that vie for influence and try to fill that void once American troops leave. And, you know, there are arguments to be made. You know, there was a lot of mistakes with how Iraq was handled and the nation building that went on, and Americans, you know, were tired of that, and rightfully so. And there's some question to be said for Syria, that we need to have, you know, concrete goals and meet those goals and gradually withdraw troops at some point. But you do that in consultation with the generals and with the foreign policy advisors that know the region and know the dynamics. You don't just, you know, make an announcement publicly via Twitter and catch all of your allies off guard, which is what we did.
Yeah, and it's easy to criticize Americans' foreign policy. I'm going to guess that you weren't a real fan sometimes of what President Obama did from a foreign policy perspective.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we lacked leadership in many areas, you know, when Obama was president, and that there were a lot of missed opportunities. And that I think President Obama, too, you know, wasn't always coherent. And and was it always consistent? If you look at the red line in Syria, which he drew back from. So, yes, but at the same point, you know, there's a lot to criticize, but there's a lot to be said for stability and not acting rash and, you know, and withdrawing too quickly.
Yeah. And foreign policy is hard. There's a lot of areas that you can easily criticize. But for me, what was so unusual about Mattis is, or what was so unusual about Trump and what Mattis points out is that 70 plus years of American foreign policy and allied building.
And that's a difference. President Obama did it upset the apple cart far as America's leadership and our alliances. He did it, you know, completely wipe the slate clean. Yeah. My criticism with him is that he didn't lead as strongly as I think he should have.
Absolutely. And that is legitimate
criticism. And that's a legitimate criticism. Yeah. But that's very different than
just completely different.
You know, tearing apart, you know, the alliances.
Because I think Obama recognized that the 70 years since post World War II have been the most prosperous and the most peaceful on this planet.
Dividend,
and the reason is because, in a lot of ways, of the American overall foreign policy. There have been times we've gotten off in the weeds. We all know that and admit that. But I think Obama and past presidents certainly had a historical knowledge and an understanding of the benefits to this approach that Trump is just completely ignorant of.
And that's a key difference. We haven't had a past president that questioned the existence of NATO, that questioned, you know, the need to act in concert with allies in the region, that, you know, took a liking to, you know, authoritarian states like Russia. I mean, that several key differences that stand out. None of that is normal in terms of our post-World War II foreign policy.
Let me ask you this question. Is it realistic that the United States president is commander-in-chief? Should those be two separate jobs? Does the president have to be the commander-in-chief at this point?
Well, you know, I think that I don't know that it's necessarily a – he doesn't – it's more of a title, I think, than reflecting, you know, his day-to-day execution.
But
I mean, that's the whole point of having a Secretary of Defense.
But he did just decide to pull troops out of a couple of places on a whim. I mean, he does have that ultimate authority.
He does. And I guess that's maybe why we would be questioning at this point, because we haven't had a prior president who would have acted like that rash.
True.
You know, with, you know, on his own. But I mean, yeah, I mean, you can probably, and I think Trump doesn't have any type of military background either, which I think
he does
makes
not.
This even more concerning. He has no, you know, experience, you know, having served at all. So that makes him even less qualified to be able to make these types of decisions.
Yeah.
And he came into office with no foreign policy experience. Now, granted, many presidents also came into office without foreign policy experience if they were governors. But the key difference is that they surrounded themselves with knowledgeable people that they listened to, advisors, cabinet officials, you know, that they would take their advice. And Trump doesn't do that. He put some of these officials into his administration, then completely sidelined them, neglected them. And they have served as little more than window dressing. And so if you're somebody like General Mattis, you know, you look at, you know, the past, you know, 2 years, it's like, why am I here? I'm basically here, you know, symbolically as window dressing. But, you know, in terms of having an impact and being effective and being able to effectively guide policy, it's not happening.
And we go back, we talk a lot about things that need to be modernized. When our army was 10,000 dudes running around with muskets, absolutely. Let the president, the civilian elected president, commander in chief, have at it. You know, now that we're a global force with the ability to reach any place, anywhere, anytime on the planet with military forces. Oh, and by the way, we could destroy the world 1,000 times over.
Right.
Maybe we need a little bit of, maybe we need somebody that's their core area of expertise, got to call in the shots.
That's a good point, because I think that, you know, before, you know, there was something to be said. You didn't want, you know, Congress with 535 members making the call, having that authority in one person, you know, in terms of being the titular head, made sense. But under the current dynamic, not so much, you know. And again, there were so many decisions leading up to this. We talked, I think it was a month and a half, 2 months ago, about the president's decision to withdraw us from the nuclear forces treaty, which gave, you know, Russia, you know, now basically leverage to completely flaunt that treaty. They were, you know, instead of imposing more sanctions, instead of exerting pressure to bring them to the table, the U.S. just decides, oh, we're going to withdraw as well. Well, now, I mean, that gives openings to all these other countries to build up nuclear stockpiles. Again, that is a direct, you know, violation of the post-war order.
So what I hear you saying is, just because you won a national popularity contest, which is what the presidency, the election of the president is rapidly turning into, you shouldn't be able to unpack 50 years of peace doctrine and military doctrine just because you feel like it.
Right. I'm not of the mindset. I don't believe for a moment that the majority of the American people, let alone the majority of Americans who voted for Trump, wanted him to undo the post-World War II peace dividend and completely usurp the world, you know, put the world order upside down. I don't buy that.
So that was part of it. That one thing was striking is it brought into clear focus how much Trump is not aligned with what traditional policy and military policy and ally policy has been.
And his policy, if you can call that, does it fall anywhere on the spectrum?
No.
It's not a coherent policy, let alone consistent.
If you categorized it this week, next week, it would be something totally different.
Right.
The other thing that really kind of struck me about this, if I've got my order of operations correct, it's him, Pompeo, and I think Bolton were on a call with Turkish prime minister or Turkish dictator Erdogan. I'm saying that wrong, but I'm close enough. And basically, Pompeo wanted the president to provide some cover for the Kurds who have been working with the United States and Syria in this area.
Right.
And almost let the Turks know, hey, you mess with those dudes, there's going to be some consequences to that. That was the stated call, the stated purpose of the call. And they get in there and Erdogan, how close am I to that?
Yeah, you're close enough. I'll go with that.
He basically says, hey, I got another idea. Why don't you just pull your troops out? Why don't you just pull your troops out and head on home and we'll take care of ISIS for you and just leave Syria and this problem to us and we'll take care of it. And apparently, and this has been confirmed by the Turks, that's pretty much how that went. So you're sitting there with your Secretary of State. Once again, this is an example of Trump. Goes against his own people.
Right.
His own people give him sound advice. He roundly ignores that and kind of sides or folds or cozies up to the advice given to him by the dictator. And this is like the fourth example of when he's done that.
Right, and it's alarming. And again, Trump has no, historical knowledge of the U.S. partnership with the Kurds, the fact that they have helped us out in Iraq and other, throughout the region, the fact that they contribute to democratic stability there, and to basically go along with Turkey and to withdraw again, it creates a void in the region.
Yeah,
and that is going to be exploited by powers like Russia, and Turkey itself has, which wants a firm U.S. ally is no longer the case.
No, they are not.
They are not, and they've been trending towards authoritarianism and dictatorship, and they have cozied up to Russia most recently. And so there's nothing you can say. I mean, it completely is irrational in terms of if you look at what our interests are, it's not our interest. I mean,
And I think people don't understand that Turkey is the largest Muslim based population per country in the world. They have a population of almost 50 million people. They have a standing army of over 600,000 or 700,000, and they project it to be a million in the next 10 to 15 years. Turkey is not just some small, unindustrialized, unmilitarized Middle Eastern country. Turkey is not Afghanistan.
No.
It is very, very different. And to your point, once they were kind of tacking to our side, Turkey is getting farther and farther and farther away from us, and we're going to have to deal with them at some point in time in the future.
Right. And make that decision. Then the other issue that's problematic too is our, relationship with Saudi Arabia also creates distance with Turkey.
Yeah.
And so, again, to make this decision the way it was made in a vacuum, it doesn't take into account any of those considerations and how that impacts the region.
And how can you just make that decision right there? Wouldn't your first inclination to be, I need to think about that. I need to consult. I can't get back to you on that right now. Even if you were considering or to say, listen, we're not doing that. What I really need you to do is this. How do you let the Turkish prime minister dictate terms to you as the American president? Is still a little bit hazy
that's
to
what I don't
how
understand.
That happened.
And that should be the case, that you would step back and consult with your advisors, even if it was our closest allies.
Yeah.
Let alone, someone who's not quite an ally, but not an adversary, someone that's ambiguous, but that you should have at arm's length and you should have completely trust their motivations.
Yeah.
So I'm completely at a loss for how this would even happen.
So of course, my side and the media gets a hold of this. Let me just ask this question. Is this, as a Republican, is how alarming is this? My side wants to portray this as, this is proof that Trump's a buffoon. We've been telling you this for 2 years. We've been crying the sky is falling. This is the first step to that happening. And now everybody should kind of see it the way that I see it. How alarming is this to you?
Well, specifically with
the Mattis situation. We'll take that disaster first before we start stacking disasters on top.
So, it's very alarming. What I'm trying to figure out is, because between the Mattis situation and the government shutdown and all of these events close together, the market is tanking, by the way. So if you look at the losses this year and in 2018, just the overall net losses, it's been the worst since like 1931, I heard.
It was the worst month in like 12 years. It was the worst week in longer. Basically, any gain through 2018
has been wiped out.
Market fell under 23,000 today. If this keeps up next week, it'll fall under 22.
And so for anybody who's looking at their portfolio, that's scary. And they're already talking about a bear market. And so, looking at possibly heading when the next recession is going to be.
Yep.
So, but setting that aside, it's hard to figure out which of these events has had the most impact. But economically, this causes a lot of concern, militarily for our allies who, felt like, okay, this guy is kind of a buffoon. We can't deal with him, but at least we can deal with, Mattis.
Yeah,
we can
at least there's some adults in the room.
There's some adults with the room, and we can, have our, back channel conversations through the adults rather than directly with him. And even if we have to have conversations with him, we know that they can, the actual policy can be mitigated.
And weren't the generals, Kelly, Mattis, I think that. I didn't think there was another one. They were supposed to bring some stability to the cabinet because they were generals. They Trump respected them just out of title and who they were, and they were supposed to be the guardrails that made sure this thing didn't fly off the edges. They're all gone now at this point.
Yeah. Well, and unfortunately, I mean, they were the guardrails with, I think, most of the employees under them. So, yeah. You know, their direct reports. But the one person they could not contain is, you know, the president. So that's where they were. They were set up to fail.
Have you ever worked for somebody who's like ex-military and like a high ranking, like a colonel or something?
Not directly. I've worked with ex-military, more in a coworker role.
Okay.
And so I know that, like, very regimented, very, you know, like clockwork, you know, methodical in terms of how they approach. And so that, and I completely buy into the idea that that's what was needed in the White House, because, I mean, that White House was anything but methodical and organized.
I'm just thinking, your boss, if you had an ex-general as a boss, that's got to suck. Because, like I said, that guy is uber organized, always on time, probably never sick, you know, has expectations of everyone around him.
Right.
And is just used to saying it, therefore it gets done. There's no, you know, as a general, if you don't want a lot of questions, you just don't have to field a lot of questions. I think Kelly was a complete mismatch at chief of staff, which that job is more messaging and nuance. And how do you control, how do you in some ways gently manipulate and get people to do things for you that they don't even know you've manipulated them into doing?
So partially, yes. I mean, part of it is organization and just being able to organize and route, you know, items where they should go and decide what the president sees and what's not worth his time.
Yeah.
But part of it also is communications. It's messaging. Yeah. And he doesn't have, he never had that background. He didn't have the political background. Yeah. He didn't have the savvy. So, you know, he was at a, was a little bit at a disadvantage because of that.
And, but where Mattis, his job and his background and his belief kind of in his belief, his understanding, his working through, his awareness of how the U.S. military worked. If that guy is not your Secretary of Defense and he quits in that fashion with that letter, who basically says everything that has made us post-World War II, the country that we are, Donald Trump doesn't believe in, who's next on the list?
Right.
Who's taking that gig?
Because you're talking about a decorated general. Well, I mean,
yes,
with years and years of experience, you're not going to have somebody of his caliber, you know, again, in this administration, let alone it'd be tough to find in any administration someone with that has his experience and expertise. And to go out that way and to not go out silently, I mean, it was intentional. I mean, he wanted to send a message.
Oh, he absolutely did. He did really well. That's how you do it. If you're wondering about how you do it, that's you don't do a tweet. That was a blast kind of across the broadside to Trump that really a lot of people felt.
Right. And I think that is key, I think, in looking, you know, and I did have a thought. Do you remember way back the anonymous op-ed?
I was thinking about that.
I started
today.
Thinking about.
I've always thought that was Mattis.
Yeah.
Or Dan Coats, one of the two.
One of the, yeah. And so Mattis came to mind again regarding that, you know, when this happened, because, you know, that story just kind of bubbled over and we moved on.
Isn't that very unmilitary-like? I mean, I don't. Yeah. I think Coates might have done it more than
probably
Mattis.
Coates, yeah.
But
Coates.
But the point was, after the context for that is that happened after Trump's Helsinki performance, and I could see someone like Mattis being so put off by that and just mortified that's the U.S. president that he could be compelled to do something like that. I still think that person, before Donald Trump is out of office, I think that person comes forward.
I feel, gosh, we have to find out who that is at some point, right? I mean, I can't say a secret.
It was too
forever.
Good.
Yeah.
There's a book in that. There's a movie in that. Oh, yeah. I mean, come on.
And that person will eventually be motivated to reveal themselves just for that reason alone, if not anything else.
The ability to monetize that op-ed is going to be too alluring for somebody. It finally came back to me what happened earlier in the week that's just been buried.
Oh, what's that?
The Michael Flynn. in judge sentencing.
Yes.
Oh. Brandon and I were sitting here thinking, it's like, okay, we got two big topics.
That
we got
feels
shut
like that
down,
was weeks ago.
But
now.
It's like something else happened that was going to be the main topic of this week, and it got pushed off.
It did.
And that's
it. And that judge didn't hold back at all. And I mean, you know, if his words and how he. And it was interesting, too, to the fact that he, you know, basically said, wait, you know, as far as the prosecution wanting to grant him, you know, immunity for cooperation, you know, the judge was like, no, these actions are beyond the pale. We need to really look at this.
So before we get to that, and I just had to spit that out. So I got it out before I forgot it again.
Right.
Because again, this is another one of those weeks.
Oh, there's so much.
There's like 4 weeks. There was the Monday, Tuesday part. There was the Wednesday, Thursday part, and now this has been dominated by a week's worth of news with the shutdown and other things that we could get to. But the Mattis thing, I think we both agree, this is a big deal. This is a flag that goes up that should cause people to kind of pause for a little bit. This is one of those reflection points. In 2 weeks, he'll name somebody else. I don't know how much staying power this has, but this is certainly one of those points to say, if you thought it could get bad, this is one of the indications that maybe it's starting to get bad.
Well, if you thought that we were just starting to go off the rails before, like we've gone off the rails now.
Yeah.
And I think this also emboldens the incoming House majority, the Democrats, to be even more aggressive in hearings and challenging the administration and to not hold back. I mean, they were planning to anyway, but this gives them even more leverage to do that.
And I heard somebody say 1/3 of the Trump cabinet is either empty after February, will be empty, or is currently staffed by a temporary appointee. That's insane. I mean, Mick Mulvaney can't take on another job.
No. Within the last couple of weeks, you know, the White House has lost an attorney, basically attorney general. They have a temporary replacement.
Yep.
You know, chief of staff, now secretary of defense.
Interior secretary.
Right.
It's just on and on and on.
And you have that against the backdrop of a government shutdown, a fight over border wall, withdrawing from Syria. I mean, all of these items, the stock market just, you know, completely reacting the way it is.
Yeah.
I mean, if that is a chaos, I don't know what is, because, and we don't have anything in recent memory to compare it to in terms of all of these different events happening simultaneously.
And what's the plan, just talking about his cabinet briefly, what is the plan out of that? It's not like a whole bunch of talented folks are going to come out and step forward and say, for America, I will do this.
No.
I mean, he's always played at the C level. It's going to be even worse.
Well, I think
now,
what we'll see play out is similar to what happened with his chief of staff, where you see kind of these, you know, public revelations of who he's considering, and you hear people, you know, basically turn the job down. I see some of that happening, and it's going to take a while. I don't think, you know, these positions are going to be filled anytime soon. Some of the lower level to mid level positions have been empty for a while now and have gone
and
unfilled.
This next person has to be Senate confirmed too.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I'm
there's going to be a battle.
If I'm in the Senate, I got a whole different set of questions for the next person that gets nominated for this job. I mean, we go right to Mattis's resignation letter and say, I agree and I believe, just like General Mattis did, he's saying to take this job, you have to have a different set of beliefs. Tell me what those are. Do you believe in the post-World War II American kind of conventional approach, or are you going to embolden whatever Trump's approach of the day is going to be?
Well, that's going to be the big question, right? There's going to be enormous pressure on the nominee to distance themselves from Trump, to, you know, indicate that, yes, you know, I am in support of the post-war order, you know, to indicate kind of where they fall. Because the big question is going to be, are they going to be a lackey for Trump? Or are they just going to, you know, basically approve his every whim and validate, you know, his, you know, whatever he's feeling or thinking at the moment?
And that's where
the concern that most have.
That's where that letter is so problematic.
Yeah.
Because it's like, okay, what the person who we all respected and the person that we felt was really good for the job, they couldn't cut it because they share the same beliefs you do. I mean, that letter has a lasting impact through the confirmation process. That's going to be, that letter makes the next person up for that very difficult to confirm.
Oh, exactly. I was talking to a buddy of mine who served in the Army, and he had talked to some of his military buddies recently,
yeah,
and a few of whom who had been like Trump holdouts, and this was like the final straw for them.
And they're and like, we're out.
They're yeah. done.
So let's talk about Michael Flynn. That was interesting that happened earlier this week. Everybody was led to believe Flynn's just going in front of this judge. He's got
very routine.
This is already set up on a tee that Mueller is saying he did everything he needed to do. We're recommending no jail time. And he gets in front of the judge and then let the hilarity begin. And this judge seemed to get off the rails multiple times.
Yeah.
But here's where, and basically the end result of this, the judge didn't immediately accept his sentence recommendation. He basically said, you're continuing to cooperate with Mueller. Come back to me. I think it's in March.
Right.
When that cooperation agreement or you think that cooperation period ends, it will reinvestigate this. Because if you're telling me I have to do this today, your ass is going to jail. And I think that's where everyone was like, whoa. What's going on here? One theory is that that judge has seen all of the redacted memos that right. Mueller's put out. He knows the scope of what Flynn's been involved in, specific as it comes to Russia, and said, if you're taking the high road, and basically said, I can't support you not going to jail knowing everything you've done.
Right. Well, and I think the judge came fairly close to calling him a traitor as well.
He asked if he could have been charged with treason.
Right.
That's a ridiculous question.
Yeah.
I mean, treason, again, has a very specific definition, and it's a capital offense. And no, Michael Flynn could not be charged with treason.
No, you can say he exercised poor judgment and made a lot of mistakes, but the yes. path of treason, it's difficult to make. But I think that also indicates, too, that the judge thinks that this is so severe that he's not going to just go blindly along with the prosecution's recommendations, which is also interesting.
And what possibly... So let's say that's not true. What possibly would be that judge's motivation for that outburst? I mean, he's a federal judge. Yeah, he ain't going anywhere.
Right.
He could sit there till he, you know, he's incapacitated or chooses to go. There is no judicial review. There is no voting him out. Why, if that weren't the case, why would he have done what he did?
And that's atypical for a federal judge to very act much that so. Way. And that's why I don't know. I tend to buy your theory that he has seen, you know, much more of the redacted yeah. information that we haven't been privy to. And that's what, you know, led up to that moment. So I think that has a lot to do with it. But I think he's also conscious, too, that until, you know, the investigation comes to a close, that, you know, not acting too prematurely in terms of, you know, ensuring that if there's any additional information that's needed from Flynn, his cooperation is still needed, that you know, you don't close the door and then, you know, everything ceases because, you know, it's already
Flynn can cooperate at any time. That's the thing with Cohn.
Yeah,
I mean, if Cohn wants to avoid the 3 years in jail from the Southern District, he can start cooperating again wherever he wants. I think the other theory is that
you could also say it sends a message, right?
I mean, it does
to, you know, others that have been indicted and that are facing charges that, you know, it's not guaranteed. I think it's problematic from the prosecution standpoint and for Mueller, and that if he has other cooperating witnesses, they may look at this and say, well, it's not guaranteed that whatever plea agreement you work out with me is going to be honored.
Yeah. The other theory I've heard is that, okay, so for the past 2 or 3 weeks, the president, his surrogates, and Flynn's lawyers have hit this theory really hard that somehow the FBI was unfair and that they entrapped Michael Flynn to lie to them.
Right.
They didn't tell him. They presented this as we're having a casual conversation. They told him he didn't need a lawyer present. They didn't specifically tell him that lying to the FBI was a crime.
And you've it's just completely ridiculous. You have to be told that lying to the FBI is a crime. Like, really? I mean, and Flynn in court was asked these questions.
Yes.
And he admitted he knew what he was doing. He wasn't ignorant of the law. So, you know, and again, Trump and his surrogates continue to put out this idea, this concept that he was entrapped, this entrapment. You know, I think Giuliani has used that word.
Yes.
yes. 100 times.
Yes.
No, I mean, that's not entrapment when you admit to knowing the law and knowing what action you're taking.
Michael Flynn is not some, you know, boob. He's like a retired 3 or 4 star general who's traveled the world.
Exactly.
Who has messed and been involved with the highest levels of government on the planet.
Right.
So this idea that he's just some rube that a couple of FBI guys tricked into lying is utterly ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it that gained so much traction because it was led by Trump. Trump was the one really pushing that. So one theory is his lawyers picked up on that. They filed some briefs. They made some statements that completely pissed off the judge. And that's what kind of set him off and got him down this path. Whatever happened, something made that guy mad.
Yeah.
And at some point, he decided in open court and on the record, even to the point where he's had to apologize and retract some stuff, that he felt it necessary to make that spectacle of himself.
Yeah, something clearly got to him.
Yeah.
And because, again, that's not normal to see from a judge. And again, I think it just shows that we're in completely uncharted territory. And, you know, and there's, again, so little that we actually know and so much that is unseen. And, you know, again, it's just that, you know, that drip drip of when we're going to actually kind of know more, you know, when this investigation concludes.
And so much about the Trump presidency is transactional, and the order of operations that things happen is everything.
Yeah.
Because it's completely believable to say that happened like Monday, Tuesday. That was an oh shit moment for Trump. He completely pivots to, I have to distract, I have to do something.
Oh, that's his MO.
That feeded to, let's just pull out of Syria. In any other
and
world,
even the grandstanding over the budget and the government shutdown plays right into, again, another distraction, because we had to really think hard to figure out what happened at the beginning of the week. It's like, oh yeah, the investigation that
this
Trump
major
doesn't want
thing
people to focus on
that everybody was focused on
right.
by Thursday is completely wiped out of your
imagine
consciousness.
Imagine that. Is that all, you know, just
gone.
Happenstance?
That can't be just
coincidence. Yeah.
I don't know what game he is playing, but once again, he is willing to do anything he has to push negative press or negative comments out of the cycle.
He's done this again and again and again.
Even if
you track
he's
his outlandish
him,
behavior
yeah.
throughout this year alone, it has usually occurred in moments when he was under the microscope or his you know, officials, campaign officials were via the investigation.
Yeah. And in Trump's weird world, getting kicked around by the base for potentially reneging on the promise of the wall is way better criticism than Russian collusion. He knows that is the only thing that if those dots are connected, that has the potential to really kind of wipe out his remaining and the legacy of his presidency. And he's completely willing to be criticized and absolutely railed on for one thing, as long as it's not this thing. And again, that's another one of his superpowers. He'll just do it over and over and over again.
Well, and he's still probably the only president of recent memory that is so beholden to his base, and specifically beholden to a particular mouthpiece of his base, that he responds in real time, you know, to that criticism. Which I think is also remarkable. He also has a very thin skin. I don't know if you heard this week, but he unfollowed Ann Coulter on Twitter because she came out
that.
And blasted him.
Yes. So Ann Coulter, Rush Limbaugh, Ben Shapiro wrote, and he had some appearances where he blasted him. The guy on Fox and Friends, Brian
Kilmeade
or whatever, he got off on him. Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, for the first time this week, looks like she just wants to throw something down and say, piss on it, I'm done.
Right.
That like mid-interview, she could just throw her hands up and say, I got nothing. This week, too, is when she gave like the 12-minute press conference and stomped out after Flynn.
Yeah.
And reporters were yelling at her, do your job. That was 12 minutes. Are you? And this was the first press conference she'd given in 3 weeks.
And it's funny because she went directly to Fox News to do an interview there, which was much longer than 12 minutes. So.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. So Flynn, Mueller, Cohn, again, all of that is starting to congeal together. There's a lot of reporting out now that Mueller is telling people early to mid-February is when he will be done. He's got a few small pieces left. Is Roger Stone going to get indicted?
That's a big question.
That'll just be fun because Roger Stone is Roger Stone.
Yeah.
Have you seen that Netflix special, Bring Me Roger Stone?
Yeah.
Have you seen the big tattoo of Richard Nixon he has on his back?
Oh, he's a character.
He's just such a goof.
He is.
That again, it's no stretch of the imagination to say that he was involved with hacking emails and stuff like that. So
no, I mean he's tended to be involved in that type of activity. And if you look at his
and proud of it.
Yeah.
And we'll admit
he doesn't shy away from it. Yeah. And I mean there's enough there with WikiLeaks to show that he was in pretty deep. I mean you can't deny that.
It feels like Mueller's got everything he needs. He's nibbling around the edges a little bit. He'll wrap this up in 4 to 6 weeks. He's going to drop this on Congress and just let it fall where it falls.
Yeah.
I think he'll make some recommendations. I think he will actually recommend to indict Trump on multiple charges. And then it's up to the Senate and the DOJ to figure out if that can happen to an existing president. It's up to the Senate because they're the one that's got to say, hey, we've got the votes to kick you out or not.
Right.
Because if we don't, and the DOJ is probably not going to indict a sitting president.
No.
You can just sit here for 2 years, I guess, and we can just look at each other and just move along. That's about what it's going to be.
That's what it would be. I mean, it would be a complete logjam. I mean, with nothing getting done.
You know you're in trouble when Cocaine Mitch comes out and says, yeah, that Mattis thing, leave it. That was pretty bad.
Yeah. I mean, Mitch McConnell has been Trump's right-hand guy. And all of Congress, I mean, helping to get, you know, his agenda through. So and rarely criticizes him.
And hey, Paul Ryan, don't let the door hit you in the ass. Go ahead and go. I've had enough of him and his farewell speeches, his 6-part documentary that he funded about his legacy. Paul Ryan, all you've done your entire career is bitch about taxes and debt. And you leave with the country in the most debt we've ever been in, and we just passed a horrendous tax law. This wraps up your lack of results and ineffective career in one neat package. Take your ass back to Wisconsin.
Well, you know, unfortunately, you know, for Paul Ryan, who's somebody I had liked for a long time, you know, he made a conscious decision to go along and get along with Trump after being
He made a conscious decision to be a puss. That's what he made a conscious decision to make.
That's pretty much what it
pretty
is.
Pretty much.
And he stay silent on all of his pet issues that he had advocated for, you know, for
he's
the
original Jeff Flake.
10 years.
If you need someone to look solemn and make a sad face, I'm your guy. If you're looking for something to get done, look somewhere else because that's not going to be me.
You got
to
put down Jeff Flake again. Come on.
At least Mitch McConnell believes in what he is doing and moves and gets his stuff done. It doesn't matter that he's a wrecking ball through our democracy, and I believe will go down in history as one of the absolute worst influences in American politics. At least he believes in what he's doing enough that he will steamroll anyone to get it done. Paul Ryan never did that.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, this was Ryan's chance as Speaker of the House to really kind of exert his voice and exercise, you know, influence, and he just buckled.
I'm glad he's gone. So let's go to the last topic of the night. It's Friday at 6:30-ish. I guess the government's going to function for about another 5 hours.
Yeah, there's a countdown on CNN and all the channels
over the wall. So help me out. As a kid, I never remember going through this conversation with shutting the government down. This whole idea of these continuing resolutions to fund the government, this is a complete political mechanism. There's no real financial or it's not like the government's running out of money. This is the agreement to allocate the money we already have.
And the government prints money, and they can print as much money as they want.
And we borrow as much money as we want.
Yeah, on both counts, we print and borrow to infinity. So it is political. It's been used as a, it's been weaponized to exact political favors and pet legislation, as we've seen throughout the years. At one point, though, there was actually legitimate discussion around the size of the deficit and the debt. And, and now there isn't. That's gone by the wayside. And now the discussion's just on political tit for tat. Yeah. You know, fund this, fund that, build this, build that. And ironically, you know, the argument now is to fund a wall, which will cost $5 billion.
Which in fairness is nothing in the grand scheme of the budget. We spend like $5 billion every 2 seconds or something like
it's
that.
It's incredibly.
Yeah. The amount of money is not the point.
Right. And, you know, and the fact is there's been, you know, throughout the year, you know, discussions of, you know, kind of broken down because there were negotiations to fund, you know, parts of the wall, you know, a billion here, a couple billion there. And, you know, those, the Republicans refused to, you know, compromise on that. And so Trump has decided that he just wants the entire $5 billion and it's either that or nothing.
Well, and this project is a $70 to $80 billion project.
Right.
What Trump's talking about is 1,000 miles of wall, or slat, or whatever the hell he's going to make fit his definition. But $5 billion is just a start. To really do what he has asked to do, it's like $80 billion.
Oh, yeah, because it's not just a wall, too. I mean, there's, you know, security, there's a lot more, and there's many components when it comes to the actual border security than just
the wall itself. Did you see Trump's tweet this morning about no one's better with technology than he is?
Oh, no, I didn't see that.
When he was talking about technology's not going to do it, we're going to have this wall because nobody knows technology like I do. This is the guy who won't send an email.
Right. Well, this is the same guy that was talking about the wall a couple of days ago and tweeted about the slabs or the slates and how... They were so pretty and pleasing, and they would be the best ever. I mean,
I guess what he's saying is, okay, we don't need a 60-foot solid concrete wall. We can do this with like metal louvers, basically, and so you can see through. It's all
silliness.
See
through to the other side. That way you can wave. Yeah.
Yeah. So you can see, and it's just
and the wall is
dumb,
feasible in places, but it's not feasible along the entire stretch of the 1,000 miles with the terrain the way it is. So you can have the wall in some places, but then in other places you need technology, you need other types of security, and that's really the way to go about it. I mean, that's feasible.
This is a semantics fight now. What's the difference between border, something to obstruct at the border and the wall? This is about not giving Trump a victory in any way, shape, or form. This is pinning this shutdown to him in 2020. This is also kicking somebody when he's down.
Well,
a lot of bads happened this week. Right. Pile on.
Well, Trump himself said he was going to take credit for the shutdown.
Absolutely.
So if you're a Democrat, you're like, okay, you own it now.
I mean, he walked right into it. Why not?
Right.
So I saw something today that the wall is to a completely partisan issue. Like 59% of Republicans are for it. It's like, you know, 70% of Democrats are against it. But if you break down by kind of geographic and ethnic region, you guys just lost the last midterm and you lost it by a historical number. That coalition that pounded and punished Republicans in the midterm, they hate the idea of this wall.
Right.
This is once again just cementing. You're going to, as a party, you're going to pay for this for the next couple cycles to come.
Well, and Trump has been his own worst enemy. And, you know, basically, he has used a wall to rally his base, but unintentionally has rallied, you know, women and suburban voters because of the way it was handled. He had that grotesque campaign ad that was downright racist, you know, about the wall. I mean, he really used it as a political weapon. And so it turned off a lot of people. I think you can make an argument that we need the wall in places with other types of border security, but the way he weaponized it as an issue, Right. I mean, there's segments of the population that are completely turned off to it now.
Yeah.
And as long as he talks about it, they're going to see fit to, you know, punish him at the ballot box.
I love when Trump quotes Reagan or references Reagan, because Ronald Reagan would light himself on fire acknowledging the ignorance that is Donald Trump. And he's like, I'm going to build this wall when Reagan tried to do it for years. Trump went on like a 12 tweet in a 45 minute bender today. And this was just one of the gems in there. And I think it was MSNBC played the actual speech where Reagan's like, instead of building money on walls and barriers, why don't we reach out to these people and one, try to solve some problems on their land so they don't come over, or make this in a way that we don't have to continually spend on border security at this level. So again, Reagan, Bush, traditional
Reagan
Republicans.
Reagan actually signed into law the first Amnesty Act, too, which extended the amnesty to persons that were here illegally.
Reagan would be on my team if he was alive today. Yeah, Reagan wouldn't be anywhere near the Republican Party right now.
I mean, Reagan would be able to get elected in a primary in the Republican Party today.
I don't think
that wouldn't happen.
I don't think you could pick the reddest of reddest states, and I don't think he couldn't get out of a primary at this point, especially with his immigration approach. There's that great scene where Reagan and Bush are debating each other in a presidential debate. And it's like each one is trying to top each other with how compassionate they want to be to immigrants.
And isn't that surreal? You would never see that at a Republican debate today.
No.
And that was the case back then.
And all of them on that stage, when they saw Trump take the hard tack right on this, and they heard some applause and pulled some good things, they all said, well, I got to run right over there with him. Nobody stood up and said, hey, guys, this really isn't how we go about this. There's better ways to do this. We don't have to have this type of conversation
well,
anymore.
Yeah, I mean, you look at just like Marco Rubio, who had to completely disavow the Gang of Eight legislation that he was a part of, which, you know, went up in flames because that was not tenable with the Republican base.
Yeah.
You could hold that type of view anymore.
So I kick Paul Ryan in the nuts. Might as well take a shot at Rubio. I love Rubio's tweet the other day when he tweeted like, oh my God, I mean, all these companies are just taking this tax money and buying back stock with it. Who knew they were going to do that? Well, you dumbass, you voted for it. What did you think they were going to do? He had another jib today where he tweeted, boy, I really hope General Mattis is retiring to spend more time with his family.
Oh, I didn't see that you, one.
I want to find a Republican to like, and I keep thinking that could be Mark Rubio until he talks. And then it's like, no, I can't do it.
Rubio is one of those that's conflicted. Like, he wants to do the right thing, and then he's always pulled back. And so he doesn't, you know.
And he just, every time he does, it gives people fodder on my side. And it makes him look like, if you could ever do something, say, that was wrong. Hey, I was thinking this way. I apologize for it. Here's how I'm going to correct that, which Reagan did multiple times in his career.
Yes.
You would coalesce a group around you in support like you've never seen before.
But that's the biggest problem we have today is politicians don't acknowledge fault, you know, starting at the top, and apologize. And they at one time they did. And that seems so, you know, out of place today, and I don't understand it because it humanizes them to a great degree, and it's frustrating when you see them dig in their heels and refuse to acknowledge. They just move on and distract and, you know, divert their attention away to something else.
My favorite Reagan story of all time is I think it was in the California governor's race. He's at a debate. There's a journalist that's putting it on who obviously is hostile to Reagan. Mm-hmm. He is, I mean, it's just oozing out of him. And he asked Reagan at some point, your reputation is to be, you know, somewhat of a dill-witted Hollywood actor who's not that smart, and you don't work that hard, and you don't have the work ethic to be the governor of California. How would you respond to that? And Reagan's line is, well, I've always heard hard work never killed anybody, but I figure why take a chance and be its first victim? Everybody roars.
Right.
The snarky journalist who asked the question, he laughs. Reagan owns that debate the rest of the way.
Reagan tended
to do
that.
Has him in his hand the rest of the way out.
Well, that's not that different from when he was debating with Carter, and there was a critical question about Reagan's age and whether or not he was up to the job. And and he made the quip. He's like, "I won't use my opponent's youth and experience against him."
Yeah.
And he had the floor at that point.
Everybody laughs. Yeah. Carter laughs. It's like, this debate's over. How come no politician could do that anymore?
I don't know.
Why is that so hard?
And be able to apologize. To do. Like during that Iran-Contra affair, Reagan went before the cameras. He apologized.
Absolutely.
When the Challenger disaster happened, that was one of his greatest addresses to the nation. Yeah. And you could tell that he felt empathy and he connected. And that's the problem with our current president. Even when he comes out and gives words of supposed empathy and grief over tragedies, they're horrible. And he doesn't connect. And it doesn't come across that he has empathy. You don't feel it.
Is it social media that's killed that? I guess social media. I'm just blaming social media for everything. Everything bad or anything that's gone to shit in this country, we just can say social media. Facebook selling all their data to Spotify and Netflix and the Russians. I don't think anybody gives a shit. But how come we can't produce another Reagan? There's nobody even close.
No.
There's nobody in the pipeline. Nobody even thinks about it that way anymore.
I think that today, I think you're right. I think with social media, with technology, with 24/7 news, we're conditioned to be very cautious and think about everything that's said and how it's said and refuse to admit fault because that's going to be detrimental. It's going to be there. It's going to be magnified. And so I think that contributes a lot to it. You get the feeling that you don't have anybody who's relatable because they don't act as a normal person would because everything's so rehearsed and so mechanical.
We're getting all excited about a 42 or 43-year-old congressman from Texas, by the way, who just lost a Senate race against the biggest douche to ever hold a Senate seat. I'm talking about Beto O'Rourke, simply because he can talk like a human.
Right.
And I don't think Beto O'Rourke is no great policy wonk. He is somebody, again, who doesn't have the depth or experience typically that I look for in a president. But in this day and age, he may be the best front runner that we can put up.
There was that Democratic poll. He's
not going to be a total butthole all the time.
Right.
I think he was like third behind Biden and Sanders,
which is significant because, again, even though he didn't win, he got 47% of the vote in a very red state. There's a feeling that he can have appeal in the South and the Midwest where another candidate might not.
Yeah.
There's a void there. Elizabeth Warren's stock has completely fallen.
If she runs, it's just brutal.
Yeah, I don't see her gaining traction back that she's lost.
No, that's a great point. Once you've lost that momentum and you've pegged that to you, there's no way you shake that stink off.
Right.
There's the people from Iowa are not going to reward her for that. I think she effectively ended her chance with her 23andMe test.
Well, they look at that as a big and unnecessary lack of judgment and unforced error. Yeah. And they're like, well, we can't trust you then because we need somebody who's on top of their game to run against their president. And we can't afford that.
I'm a donor. I'm not writing you a big check so you can do another, pull something like this halfway through and just flush yourself down the toilet.
Too risky.
So I was all fired up this week to talk about, to have a conversation about HR1, which this is a massive reform package that Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats are saying this is the first thing that they're going to tackle. And HR1 is the biggest package of campaign reform and congressional reform that's come down the pipe in a very, very long time. There's some very kind of radical ideas about campaign financing and lobbyists. All of the drain the swamp rhetoric that Trump threw out, Pelosi and the Democrats are putting into a package to try to push forward. There's also a gentleman in the House who is proposing another crazy idea, and I think the city of Seattle does this. What if we financed campaigns where every citizen in the United States over the age of 18 got 4 vouchers worth $50 each, and you just gave those vouchers to whatever candidate you wanted. They could only be used they could only be used for political purposes. They had no cash value, but that's the way we funded. And the theory is that now everybody comes into play, because I can chase down my vouchers through the corporate crowd, because I have an interest in changing the tax structure. I can chase it through the middle class. I can chase it through the poor. So there's a couple of things.
So everybody has the same number of vouchers. So how does that impact, I guess, non-persons? So like, you know, when you look at PACs or corporations or organized interest groups, how would they come into play?
The Republican concept that a corporation has the same rights as a person.
You don't think a corporation's a person?
This. No, okay. A corporation is not a person. This, you can have your PAC. You can do all of that. We're not touching Citizens United. We're not touching super PACs. All we're saying is that if you wanted to give your four vouchers to a super PAC, go ahead. But they do this in Seattle, and I need to do some research on how this works. But the point is that the Democrats are starting to recognize that Trump's drain the swamp mantra had a lot of attraction to Republicans.
Yeah.
And maybe there's a way we can tap into that by talking about serious corruption, campaign, and government reform.
Well, I think that's good. And I'm not, just from what I've heard, I'm not too keen on that specific model. But
that doesn't really do it for you.
No, I don't know. I feel like that could work probably at the city level, like in Seattle. I don't know about
really
nationally.
It'd be hard.
But again, there are limits. There's significant regulation that can be enacted that we don't have in place today. I mean, it's, you know, money in politics is one of the most unregulated areas of society, and especially compared to other Western democracies where they have it much more, you know, restrained. I mean, if you look at the UK, if you look at Canada, much more regulated. And so it prevents, you know, any, you know, one company or corporation from having an outsized influence. And so there's plenty of ways to do that.
And what's interesting is that the Democrats, I'm interested to see how this plays out. None of these laws none of this legislation has a snowball's chance in hell of passing the Senate.
Right.
If Mitch McConnell has done one thing, he has showed his commitment to keeping money in politics time and time and time again. Cocaine Mitch, these won't even be debated in the Senate.
But what it does is it gives the Democrats a chance to create a platform for 2020 and get this issue out into the forefront.
And I think what they're telling the 15 people that are going to run for president on the Democrats, here's something that you can create some differentiation on yourself. Here's a platform that you can adopt. I agree with you. I think that's why they're pushing this forward, knowing that they don't have any real chance to get any of this through the Senate. But they are going to try to bring this to the national conversation for their 2020 candidates.
Which would be good for them. I mean, the Democrats did very well in 2018 in spite of not really having a coherent message or what I thought a coherent, like, contract with America type of agenda. But I think that's even more important for them to have something like that going into 2020 for differentiation.
Well, there's going to be so many faces. You got to find a way that they start seeing differences. Do you have all your Christmas shopping done? You got to do any more?
I do. I'm all done as of a couple days ago.
I got to get my wife one more thing. And there's always, you know, there's that thing she wants, and then we try to surprise her with something, and it's a crap gift.
You know, brave the crowds at the retail
stores. I don't mind that much. Yeah. We were at Nebraska Furniture Mart like last week, and the Grinch was there. Not even Santa Claus. There was the Grinch.
Dressed up as a Grinch.
And there was
like
900 kids in line to see some middle-aged dude in a Grinch costume. To be honest, it made me so thankful I don't have little kids anymore. Because it'd be like, no, I am not standing in a four-hour line.
I don't see you have the patience, with little kids to do something like
that. No way. I like little kids in small chunks.
Small doses.
Then it's like, that's...
And then you hand them off like, here, you can have them back.
Yeah. I tell Jed, we are so happy. We're out of that phase, and we're just never going back.
Were you like that when you were younger as a dad, too? Was it the same way or not so much? Or you probably had more patience, I would think.
You do. As you get older, your patience for children... You hit this weird where my kids are like 16 to 19. So they're pretty much on their own. And you have this huge dip where you have no patience and you hate kids. And I'm assuming it spikes back up when you become a grandparent.
Yeah, the grandkids.
Or it doesn't. It just levels off and you just never want to be around kids again, which I totally understand that too. It happens. That's our hour. Thanks, Brandon.